So, our topic this evening is the phenomenon of the rabbinical conference. In Germany in the 19th century, there were three very famous rabbinical conferences that happened in three consecutive years, 1844, 1845, 1846, at which the serious issues facing Judaism were up for discussion. Now, the idea of a rabbinical conference, of like-minded members of the Jewish clergy, was already being proposed by Abraham Geiger in late 1830s. And in fact, he had, at Wiesbaden, in his hometown, where he was the local rabbi, in 1837, a gathering of 14 rabbis. And when he put out the call, the epistle, for people to show up, he explicitly stated that this gathering will not have synodal authority. We will not have the right to impose new rules on Judaism. That, no. It's merely a gathering for people to express their views about the best way to conduct the office of the rabbi. It's a professional gathering for the sharing of ideas. And they got together, and they accomplished nothing. And Geiger was a little disappointed that he had bigger hopes for his conference than what materialized.
So prior to that, Rabbonim never got together?
So Rabbonim did get together in the old world on a small scale in Central and in Eastern Europe when the occasion required it, when there was a crisis. But just for the sake of having a gathering to discuss topics of interest,
like a convention,
that's a new idea. It's unclear what he thought they could accomplish, but they accomplished nothing. It was deliberative, not authoritative. Well, in 1844, the movement is progressing rapidly.
Which movement?
The Reform movement. And Ludwig Philipson, the editor of the German Jewish newspaper and the preacher at Magdeburg, he calls for a conference to take place at Brunswick, or Braunschweig, in the summer of 1844. And the purpose of that conference was fourfold. Number one, to bring rabbis into closer relation and acquaintanceship. Basically, you know, we have the opportunity to take the railroad now, or to have faster means of communication or travel. The rabbis should know each other personally, because in a bygone era, they knew of each other by name or by reputation, but not face to face. So if you can get together and actually know a person, be a chaver, a friend, that is a positive development. Number two, to promote unanimity in the conduct of the rabbinical office. So basically, people should comport themselves in a similar manner, and we shouldn't have wild diversity in the way people conduct themselves. Three, to further the founding of communal institutions. In other words, German Jewry should have national institutions of Jewish interest, whether it's a seminary, whether it's national philanthropy, or the like. Instead of just local or municipal Jewish philanthropy, let there be at the national level. Four, to take counsel on all Jewish affairs, meaning even things that are not specifically religious. Let the rabbis get together to discuss them, so that the rabbis play a role where otherwise the layman might take over complete dominance. I mean, for example, in American Jewish life, you have the alphabet soup of American Jewish philanthropic organizations, and usually there's some, you know, rabbinical board that they ignore, that's entitled to raise an opinion. But really, it's the laymen who control it, the ones with the purse strings, and the ones who hold the executive positions. But here, that doesn't exist yet. So let the rabbis be the first ones to get together for these purposes and have the dominant say. Okay. So the rabbis get together. And the first thing they decide upon is that this gathering should become a permanent institution. It shouldn't just be a one-off, but rather we should get together every year. You know, they like the Concord Hotel, Chaim Isha Lake. The conservative rabbis went there every year for 30 years straight. I think that was it was a great place to go to. It was fun.
The RCA also?
The RCA was at the Homework, which was not as good. So
the Pine View,
yeah. So, they wanted it to be a permanent institution. Now, the goal was to develop and enliven the spirit of Judaism on the premise that Judaism is in serious decline, and that the spirit of Judaism is being lost among the people, and the rabbis are the last best hope to figure out a solution to save Judaism.
So yeah. How did this figure in timeline-wise with what was discussed last week?
So last week was the issue of circumcision. So the Frankfurt Society of Friends of Reform was established in 42-43. The Brisk controversy was in 43-44. It is still ongoing as the Brunswick Conference is taking place, meaning there are still publications and nasty op-ed pieces in Jewish periodicals being written on this very topic. So it will be one of several important topics they want to cover. But it's such a hot-button issue that in the end they drop it. They don't want to touch that issue because it's too much of a current controversy.
Is he one translated from German into the Hebrew Bible into German?
No, that's a different Philipson. This is Ludwig Philipson, yeah. So the question that they start off with, before we make any decisions, of what binding character are our decisions going to have? Meaning, we might decide some things here, but are we beholden to whatever maskana, whatever conclusion we reach at this conference? So they came to the decision that nobody can be declared absolutely bound by the decisions of the gathering of rabbis, but that they are morally bound to try their best to implement these decisions within their communities to the best of their ability.
Guidelines,
right. Not standards of practice, but guidelines. And the purpose of coming to decisions, even if they can't be implemented by force, is so that a rabbi who finds himself in agreement with the decisions of the convention and has an unwilling population back at home, the rabbi can tell his congregants, his members, that my decision or my opinion is not one man's opinion. It is expressing the sentiment of a whole gathering of German rabbis. Okay. So, if the congregants don't like it, the rabbi's not going to be able to force it down their throats, but he'll probably have at least a minority that agrees with him, and if he can say, I'm not the only rabbi who feels this way, but I have 10 other colleagues or 20 other colleagues who agree, maybe that is moral suasion. Who knows?
Rabbi, you had mentioned that the German government is involved in this because everyone has to register for a specific religion.
Yeah.
The point that when it came to the question of circumcision, the government was unhappy because that would mean that these people would not be registered as Jews.
Well, in some jurisdictions, the government was insistent upon circumcision if the Jewish authorities won't register the child as Jewish absent that circumcision. Yeah.
How about these outlines?
Okay. Nothing to do with it. The government is not all that interested in what the rabbis have to say about the prayer service or about Sabbath observance or the other host of issues that will come up, except for marriage law. Marriage law they're going to care about because it's a civil issue that involves registration of the marriage with the governmental authorities. And so we're going to see that the real radical types want to do away with the Jewish marriage ceremony and divorce and want to turn it into just a civic affair. And the government would say, all right, fine with us. Okay.
So how many individuals were there?
There were 25 rabbis at this first gathering in Brunswick. Okay. Not exactly. The divisions will emerge right away. And there are three different camps. So, Holdheim, who is one of the most radical of them all, he says in his opening address, we have the ability to manipulate Judaism just as the Anshei Knesset had the power to manipulate Judaism. So he's arrogating for himself no power and a lot of power simultaneously, meaning I'm not the boss of anyone. But then again, neither were the Anshei Knesset Hagadolah. Yet the general Jewish public accepted their rulings for 2,000 years. So the general Jewish public will accept our rulings if we come to them in good faith. It's a nice way of being humble and having hubris simultaneously. Okay, what were the various factions that were in this group, in this convention? So as David Philipson, who writes the Monumental Reform Movement in Judaism, and this was written originally in 1907, was republished in 2002, he claimed there were three factions. What he called the hyper-Orthodox faction, which is a code word for nominally traditional, By his, you know, for him, that's hyper-Orthodox. So there are those who believe that the Shulchan Aruch should be the guiding light of Judaism, and that any reform that is instituted must at least pass some muster with the Shulchan Aruch and the Talmud. Then there are the extreme radicals on the other side who believe in ethical monotheism and not much else. And then there's the party of compromise, which is in between. The radicals are only a handful. The extreme traditionalists are only a handful. And most people are the party of compromise who want to see reforms and maybe even believe in their heart of hearts like the radicals, but are hesitant to express it openly lest they cause a fissure in the community or get themselves fired. Okay. The most Orthodox fellow at the convention was a Rabbi Schott, S-C-H-O-T-T. And his complaint on the very first day when he heard whisperings about radical reform, he said, "Shall we always negate?" Meaning everything I hear in this convention is about what we're going to do away with, not what we're going to preserve. So shall we always negate? Is everything in the negative to take an axe and chop off limbs of Judaism? To which Samuel Holdheim, the radical, said, "What you call negation, I call preservation." And Abraham Geiger, a year later, would use the Talmudic expression that stira al manat livnot binyanhu, that destruction, demolishing, for the sake of eventually building back up, is in fact the malacha of bona, of building. It looks like demolition, but it's in fact a constructive act. If he sees it that way. Okay. One of the big topics they felt was essential to cover, but for which they had really had no solution, and we're going to have to talk about it at length, not this week, but next week, because it was the main topic of the third conference in 46 at Breslau, was the Sabbath. The basic problem is this. The civic day of rest is Sunday. The Jewish Sabbath is Saturday. People go to work. Kids go to school. Well, what are we going to do about it? And tinkering with the Sabbath laws, the concept of malacha, of forbidden labor, doesn't really change the calculation at all. It may make a person feel less guilty about kindling a flame, or tying a knot, or slaughtering a cow, you know, violating the 39 Talmudic versions of labor. But it doesn't change the fact that the day of rest, which the Jews are supposed to observe, is not the one they can observe. So 2 years later in 46, they would deal with it at length. But they understand right away that we'll eventually have to tackle this subject. They know it's the most important. Okay. Another topic that on the second day of the convention was whether or not there should be a declaration of principles. And there are two schools of thought here. One school of thought is, well, if we don't have a declaration of principles, how can we take positive action on practical agenda items? Meaning, if we don't know what our basic theological guidelines are, how could we make decisions about, you know, tinkering with the halakha here and there? On what basis are we doing it? So we must have a declaration of principles first, and then make decisions about halakha l'maaseh second. Sounds reasonable? Reasonable enough. But others took the exact opposite approach and said, no, Judaism doesn't believe in a catechism. That's a Catholic thing. That's a Christian thing. That Judaism either doesn't have dogmas or doesn't have any binding dogmas. The concept of dogma in Judaism had been around since the days of Mendelssohn and would remain a topic of concern in Jewish philosophical thinking 100 years after this convention. But the notion that there's nothing binding in the realm of belief is a very tempting idea if you're a radical, because it means that the old Maimonidean creed of the Yud Gimel Karim can be dismissed very casually. Okay, so you might have thought that the traditionalists wanted a declaration of principles, and the radical reformers don't want one. As it turned out, it was a mixed bag. Some radicals wanted declaration of principles because they thought they would win and the declaration themselves would be very radical. Others were opposed because they don't like dogma and they want to have freedom even against their own colleagues. And among the traditionalists, there were those who were afraid of a declaration of principles lest it be too radical. And there were others who thought that, no, we'll get a traditional statement of belief which will translate into traditional viewpoint on halakha l'maaseh. So it was across the board a range of opinions and didn't depend upon what camp you were in.
Yeah.
Okay. So a dogma is, to put it simply, a belief that is an essential component of the faith, which if you are lacking in belief in that dogma, you are somehow either a heretic or not going to achieve salvation.
So that would be the Rambam's first things that we mentioned.
Yeah. Okay. A catechism is like a laundry list of things that you have to subscribe to, that often in Christianity the kid would have to recite at their bar mitzvah, the Christian version of bar mitzvah.
That was basically beliefs.
It was not mitzvah. It's a laundry list of beliefs. I believe the following, X, Y, and Z.
So in Hebrew, a dogma is a mitzvah?
No, a dogma is an essential principle. Would be a rishima, a list of such dogmas. Okay. Well, another topic of great controversy is that of intermarriage. And it's surprising that they even addressed it, because they didn't have to, since it wasn't really a terrible crisis as it is in America today. The numbers were fairly low in 1840s Central Europe. Primarily because intermarriage was in many places still illegal. You had to be of the same faith. And in many places, a Gentile couldn't convert to Judaism, but a Jew could convert to Christianity. So in order to have an intermarriage, you'd have to have someone be a mishumad, an apostate, first. So it was a fairly low number, but they addressed the issue. Why? Because the Paris Sanhedrin of 1807 had already addressed the issue, and these, being very progressive rabbis, looked to the Paris Sanhedrin of 1807 and say, ah, that's our forerunner. And what did the Paris Sanhedrin say about intermarriage? Is it kosher? Is it treif? So the Paris Sanhedrin actually said that if a Jew marries a fellow monotheist, and it is civilly binding, Judaism is not going to do anything to stop it. It recognizes the civilly binding character of that intermarriage. What the Reform rabbis then did was twist that into saying that Judaism doesn't forbid a marriage between a Jew and a fellow monotheist of another faith, and as long as the children can be reared within the Hebrew faith. So the caveat is the children need to be Jewish, but if the children are going to be Jewish, the relationship itself is not forbidden. The extremist of all the rabbis, who was mamish an anti-Semite, was Rabbi Mendel Hess of Weimar, Saxe Weimar. He was the most anti-Semitic rabbi in the history of Judaism. You heard it here. Mendel Hess, for the recorder. Died in 1871. And he wanted to add to the declaration the words, and the rabbi is permitted to solemnize them. Meaning not just that it's not forbidden, but the rabbi can officiate. Bear in mind, this is 1844. This is not 1909 in the Midwest in the United States, and it's not 2017. It's 1844. And he wants rabbis to be granted the permission to solemnize an intermarriage. But then again, he tried to destroy Judaism every way he could. Doesn't matter, as long as the law will allow the child to be reared as a Jew, sufficient.
Whether or not he's Jewish.
They're not concerned with the halakhic niceties. They're just
concerned.
Yeah, that's
it.
If Christianity believes in Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, is that monotheistic?
So, for all purposes here, Christianity is assumed to be a monotheistic faith. Although in the days of the Rishonim that was a debated point, with the consensus opinion being that Christianity is idolatry, and only Meirika type opinions said that Christianity was kosher for Gentiles, that's in the 12th, 13th century. We're now in 1844, when it would be absolutely beyond the pale for a progressive rabbi to get up and say Christianity is Avodah Zarah. They're not going to say that. No way are they going
to
say that.
But it seems to me that the Christian had the same rule, that if you married a non-Christian, as long as the children were raised in the Christian religion.
Yeah.
So it's the same ball game.
That's true, but who's to say that we have to have the same guidelines that they do?
They did.
You're right. Okay. No. God forbid.
They were no Puerto Ricans.
What was the view of the state? In other words, did the state determine what religion a child was, or did they just go
It depended upon the jurisdiction. In some places, one Christian parent was enough for the church to have the hold over the child and to insist upon baptism and to prevent the rearing of the child within the Jewish faith. And it didn't matter whether mother or father, one was enough. Which is exactly why the Paris Sanhedrin and the Reform rabbis of the 1840s have to stipulate that it's only on condition that the state allows you to rear the kid that way, because it's not always true. In plenty of jurisdictions, they didn't let. So under those circumstances, they couldn't allow the intermarriage. Yeah.
Just as a sidebar, the Mortara case, uh-huh. Even though it didn't play into that, I wonder where somehow or other these guys were foreigners or something like that. Certain of these characters, you know.
I would imagine they were against his being kidnapped and being forcibly baptized. Yeah.
But still, once he was under their jurisdiction, they...
Lozengain. I don't know. Okay, so the Committee on Liturgy was appointed to address certain matters of synagogue practice and to report at the following year's convention, which would happen in 1845 in Frankfurt. So what were the six things that they were supposed to work on? And we get to in a few minutes to the Frankfurt Convention, we'll address what answers they came up with. Number one, the extent to which Hebrew should be retained in the service. Now already with the Hamburg Temple controversy, we discussed the issue of Hebrew versus vernacular in the service, but it will become again a major controversy. The second one, to what extent should the dogma of the Messiah be part of our davening? Number three, do you need to repeat the Shemona Esrei? Number four, what about the status of the Torah reading and calling people up for aliyahs? Is it really necessary? Fifth, what about Netilat Lulav and Tekiat Shofar? So I keep bringing these two mitzvahs up, Shofar and Lulav. Why so much of an obsession with Shofar and Lulav? Why?
Very popular.
So it's popular among those who like positive Judaism, but it's an embarrassment among those who want to have a European-style service and think that that Orientalism is to be totally removed from the Jewish house of worship. That may be, there may be a hint of that as well, too.
What about a hint of Palm Sunday?
Right.
Palm Sunday, right.
That I haven't thought of.
Do they have it then?
No. And lastly, what about organ? Is an organ permitted? And so organ and the extent of Hebrew was already adjudicated in the Noga Hatzedek and the Or Noga and the Eli Divrei HaBrit in the 18-teens. Okay. So those are things for them to think about for the following year. But in 1844, some other items were on the agenda. Another one was the Mora Judaico, the Jewish oath. Now, we've mentioned the Jewish oath as being something that if a Jew wanted to testify in court in relation to a Gentile, he could not simply have his word accepted or, you know, put his hand in a Bible and that's it. No. You needed a rabbi to take a Torah scroll out of the synagogue, and they would have to involve a certain ritual of spitting and swearing and promising that Kol Nidre will not undermine what I'm about to say. The consensus of the rabbis at this gathering was that a Jew can be believed on his say-so alone. We don't need an elaborate ritual to prove the veracity of a Jew's statement.
Is that the state who required this?
Often the state required it, yes.
So how could
yes.
they adjudicate against what the estate said?
So they're not saying that they have the power to undo what the state says is the binding law. They're just claiming that if we could petition the state to eliminate this, we would tell the state that a Jew is an honest person and should be believed on the basis of just a simple promise, or a simple oath, not an elaborate oath involving sacred items and bizarre rituals.
Would you be offended? Because you're saying basically that the Jews, you know, real tzaddik and all you got in Romans.
No. They're not saying that. They're saying that the unfair standard of requiring a Jew to go through an elaborate ritual that the Gentile doesn't have to in order for that Jew's word to be believed is unnecessary and unfair, and therefore should be eliminated in the law.
Substitute with
a simple hand in the Bible is good enough.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Let's skip a little bit here. Okay. So when the conference was over, many, many rabbis railed against it, including 116 Orthodox rabbis who signed a petition called Shlomei Emunei Yisrael, in which they accused the reformers at Brunswick of being as bad as the Karaites and the Sadducees, and supporting the rule of convenience and sensuality. In other words, the doing away of the law is not a way of preserving Judaism. It's the doing of the way of the law because you just don't like it. You don't like the burdens of the halakha. You want to have convenience and sensuality. Therefore, it's all is fair game. That's the
rabbis of shuls.
The ones who communal rabbis, yes.
Real
positions, yes.
About these clowns on the other side of the
world. So the other ones all had communal positions, but they weren't necessarily all ordained rabbis. They might have been preacher, the prediger, the one who holds the position of sermonizer in the house of worship. A darshan. So not necessarily a musmach of some yeshiva or some accepted rabbi. Okay. But the Orthodox were not the only ones to criticize the convention. Even some of the reformers themselves didn't like what happened. Ludwig Philipson, who called the convention into being, was disappointed that it was primarily about doing away with practical mitzvot and not building up Jewish communal institutions. That was his original purpose. Okay, so he was saddened by all the negativity. Another one was Zacharias Frankel. Zacharias Frankel comes to be known as the grandfather of positive historical Judaism, which is the forerunner of conservative Judaism. Okay, in all the history books of American conservative movement, they'll point to Zacharias Frankel as their forebear. He was born in 1801, dies in 1875, was the rabbi in Dresden from 1840 till 1854, and then takes over the position as the rector of the Jewish Theological Seminary of Breslau. He beats out Abraham Geiger for the job, and Geiger never forgave him for it. They didn't like each other for a whole host of reasons.
He kept that JTS.
With his bare hands, he held on tight and kept it very, very traditional. No practical reforms really were of any kind were allowed. Although there was the Wissenschaft des Judentum, there was the scientific study of Judaism, it didn't manifest itself with tinkering with halakha l'maaseh. Okay. Nothing. The philosophy was not that of old line orthodoxy. It was a more moderate theological point of view. So, what was Frankel's problem with the 1844 conference? Basically, he says, these rabbis are ignoring the will of the people. The will of the people is that the mitzvot should be preserved when they have an emotional hold over Am Yisrael. That where the people still have an attachment, sentimental attachment, to a certain observance, religious observance, ritual observance, it's wrong to take it away. That even if you, the progressive rabbis, think that the times, the zeitgeist, has moved past this ceremony of the Bible or of the Talmud, if the people still like it and find religious satisfaction in it, who are you to take it away? So, in the 20th century, in the conservative movement, the classic expression was Puk Chazei Mayama Dabar. Go see what the people are doing. If the people still keep this mitzvah, you can't take it away. Now, it also means if the people aren't doing certain things, you can take it away. But Frankel always estimated the religiosity of the general public to be on a higher madrega, a higher level than that which the Holdheims and Geigers of the world thought the people were at. The Holdheims and Geigers always assumed that the people are observing nothing, Judaism is dying, we have to reform it, otherwise it's a lost cause.
Where was it? Shomer Torah and Mitzvah.
Yes.
And that is the deciding factor. Without that,
so Frankel is a Shomer Torah and Mitzvah, but Frankel also speaks of the general public as though they are still, to a significant extent, Shomer Torah and Mitzvah. Was he right? It depends where. In every kehil, every community, it's a different story. In some places, there is a greater degree of religiosity. In some places, there's a greater degree of assimilation. But Frankel always guessed on the side of tradition and traditionalism of the people, not on the side of the people's apostasy and heresy. Okay. So, in response to Frankel, the reformers have to offer some counter-argument and say, no, we're right, you're wrong. So, Holdheim says to Frankel in an op-ed piece in late 1844, you know, you're saying if the people like it, we should keep it. Well, there are all sorts of mishagasin and minag shtus and superstitions that the people keep. We're gonna observe those too?
For example.
Well, he doesn't list them. But just from our own experience, we know that there are certain Judaic practices that are not especially Judaic. They're more pagan in nature. They've crept into Judaism at some time and place. And some people are very attached to them and would call me a heretic for belittling those practices. I'm not going to say which ones. But sometimes even the Shulchan Aruch calls a certain practice the Darkei HaAmori. And that should tip off those who know the Shulchan Aruch what I'm referring to. But there are many superstitions in Judaism that do have a hold over some of the people. So he's telling Frankel, you're not an old world Orthodox rabbi. You're a moderate. Are you going to say that if the people like crazy superstition, we should keep it? And then he says, suppose instead of being the rabbi in Dresden, you were the rabbi in Moldavia or Wallachia, where the Hasidim are the dominant element within the Jewish community. Are you going to go for all of their mishigas? That's what he says to him. Frankel, you're a modern rabbi. You know, stick with the modernity. Don't say the people should preserve superstitions because the people like it. He went on, so Holdheim goes on to say that the genuine Jews of Eastern Europe are consistent in their observances. They disdain any secularism. They consider it a shanda to read a German language book, that you're a poshea bel kei Yisrael, you're a sinner against the God of Israel if you pick up anything with secular writing in it. They're consistent. They make sense for them. But you, Frankel, no, you don't make any sense. So what Holdheim is basically saying is that there can be no such thing as modern orthodoxy or conservatism or positive historical Judaism. There is nothing between radical reform and the Hasidism of Eastern Europe. Those two extremes make sense. Everything in between makes no sense. All right, to him it makes no sense. All right. He didn't want it to. You're right. Yeah. Yeah. Not that I'm aware of. In what sense would that be used?
Sure, you know, because they're arguing the same items from different points of view, different directions, opposite directions.
I haven't seen it. So now we go to 1845, and the rabbis gather at Frankfurt. So
this is the third.
This is the second convention.
Second.
It picked up steam. It picked up plenty of steam. And the most important thing that happened in Frankfurt in 1845 was that Frankel showed up. Here he had criticized them viciously for being beyond the pale, for doing all the wrong things. And then he shows up at the next year's convention. Why?
Wants to influence it.
He knows that the radicals are only an element of the German rabbinate, not the preponderance of the rabbinate, or even necessarily the dominant camp. So he figures, if I show up, I can influence the outcome. But he was wrong, because in the end he doesn't influence the outcome, and he has to leave on the third day in disgust. Okay, so the first issue is the extent to which Hebrew language will be in the davening. And here, the suggestion of the Prayer Book Commission was that the following items be retained in Hebrew. Baruch Hu et Hashem HaMvorach, Baruch Hashem HaMvorach Le'olam Va'ed, Shema Yisrael through the end of the first paragraph of the Shema, the first three brachot of the Shemona Esrei, the last three brachot of the Shemona Esrei, and the Torah reading. Is that a lot? Not much. I mean, the truth of the matter is the Torah reading is a tremendous amount. That's a whole lot of Hebrew. I mean, if you have 100 psukim in a random parsha, that's a lot more than the three brachas and the three brachas in the Shema. So the bulk of the Hebrew is in the laning. But the prayer service is in the vernacular. That was the suggested amount of Hebrew to be retained.
Excuse me, but in the vernacular, I can only see that the service itself had to have been abbreviated. You didn't have
Of course. Certain things are going to disappear completely because they're not especially beloved to the people. Yep. You know, korbanos, yikum purkan, whatever it might be. There are things that the davening public doesn't especially want to preserve if it could do it all over on its own.
Right. Also, a slippery slope that the less Hebrew you have to know to participate in the prayer.
Yeah. Yes, that's going to be a very important argument in favor of retaining Hebrew, that in the davening, because if you don't, There's no incentive to learn it, and if it's lost, it's lost forever. Okay, so...
Like today in America, yeah. Most German Jews did not speak and did not know how to read.
So, most men who were synagogue goers probably could read Hebrew. The extent to which they understood what they were reading depended upon their level of education, but it was probably very limited. And the women, for the most part, could not read Hebrew by this point because Yiddish was no longer, or Judeo-Deutsch was no longer their vernacular. They were speaking real German, and they were reading it in the Latin characters. Okay, so what are the arguments in favor of more or less Hebrew? The argument in favor of less Hebrew is that if people don't understand it, then why do it? Let there be no waste of time at the edifying service. Let it all be edifying. And that can only happen in a language you understand. Moreover, you can't pour out your heart to God in a language you don't understand. Well, can you or can you not? So Einhorn, David Einhorn, who was one of the radicals who moved to America in 1855 and becomes one of the most important American Reform rabbis, so he says, in the old days, prayer was a cry of pain. In the days of the medieval ghetto, it was a cry of pain. And for that, you can even use a barely intelligible language like Hebrew. Because the krechts can happen in any language. Even if you don't understand the word, the sentiment is there. But now that we're no longer crying in pain, but rather living the good life in the Western civilization, whatever we're trying to say had best be said in a language where we can really articulate it, and that is only the European languages, no longer Hebrew.
How similar that is to the after Vatican II, with having to go only in the vernacular.
Yeah, yeah.
Roman Catholic Church forbade it.
Yeah.
It was Cardinal Lefebvre who did it in Latin, was excommunicated.
Yeah, sure.
And the same thing, I think ultimately they went back into to Latin.
There's a mixture, I think.
No, not at all.
I think vernacular is permitted.
Vernacular is permitted, but there's still an element of Latin.
You like it?
Yeah.
But beforehand you couldn't do it.
Yeah, so you couldn't do anything.
There were three questions. There were three questions before the convention. One, to what extent is Hebrew objectively legally necessary in the service? Two, to what extent is Hebrew necessary objectively but for reasons beyond the technical letter of the law? And three, to what extent is it subjectively necessary? So objective legal, objective for reasons that are beyond legal, and subjective. Can you define those three questions accurately? They sound very similar. Certainly the first two sound a lot alike. So on the first question, whether it's objectively legally necessary to have Hebrew, they decided almost unanimously that the answer is no. Because as we saw in the Hamburg Temple controversy, it's permissible to daven in any language. The Mishnah, the Talmud, the halachic codes all make clear that you are allowed to daven in another language. Now the question was whether that was a yachid or a rabim, individual versus community. They're not worrying about those minutiae here. What they say, if the law, the halacha, as traditionally codified, says you can pray in any language, so we don't need it for legal reasons. But do we need it for other objective reasons, namely the preservation of a common bond in B'nai Yisrael, the Jewish people all around the world? That if we all pray in the same Hebrew language, we have a kinship. Whereas if we all revert to a local vernacular, I, the German Jew, have nothing to do with, at least synagoguely speaking, the Frenchman who happens to be a Jew, or the British man, or the American. So that is another reason why you would want to preserve Hebrew. Another reason is because if you don't have Hebrew in the davening, you won't learn it in the cheder. If you don't learn it in the cheder, you won't learn how to read the Bible. And then what's going to happen if you can't read the Bible? You won't know what Judaism is. And aside from the assimilation factor and you'll be gone from Judaism altogether, there's another thing. It will create a division between the professional theologian and the non-theologian. That traditionally, what is the Jewish way? Everybody studies Torah. And everybody's a Bissell scholar, a little bit of a Lamdan. And the rabbis might have smicha and ordained to know a little bit more, but everybody knows something and there's a spectrum of learning. Whereas if you don't have Hebrew in the davening, everybody's in Amaretz, and 1% will be rabbis who'll know something. And that's really bad. Okay, so what was the decision on whether it was objectively necessary for non-legal reasons? And the answer is 13 said yes and 15 said no. It was defeated. Now, on subjective grounds, whether it's a good idea to keep Hebrew in the prayers at least for a little while longer, it was decided almost unanimously yes. So it's not legally necessary. It is subjectively necessary, but is it objectively necessary for non-legal reasons? 13-15. Frankel went nuts, and he left the convention and said, "You guys are no good. I'm out of here." And he tries to form his own convention the following year of theologians, which doesn't pan out. It never happens. But it was mostly to just siphon away possible participation from the next year's Reform Convention. Okay, so Frankel is really bothered by the Hebrew issue.
And why did he fail to gather it together? I think it was the people that he would get it together were really Orthodox.
Right. So there isn't.
They wouldn't even want to get together on anything.
Correct. There isn't much of a middle camp.
Yeah.
There's Orthodoxy. There is Reform of varying stripes. But Frankel-style positive historical Judaism doesn't have much of a constituency yet in the 1840s. By the 1860s, 70s, 80s, 90s, it will have something of a constituency, and his seminary will produce very high-quality rabbis who serve in prestigious positions all around the world. But in Europe, there never really was that middle group the way there was in America with conservative Judaism. Now, one of the reasons why is because the Reform movement in Europe, although we're talking about a lot of radical changes here, it really never happened to that significant extent, other than in a few isolated cases of radical congregations like in Berlin and Frankfurt and in Hamburg. Other than that, most of the Reform congregations in Europe were moderate congregations. So if you have moderate Reform and you have a neo-Orthodoxy, what space is there on the spectrum for that proto-conservative Judaism? Not much of one. In America, you have it because the Reform were practically heathens. I mean, if you read the Pittsburgh Platform, they believed in nothing. So that's why you had the opportunity for a middle group to develop between Orthodoxy and the Reform of the likes of Isaac Mayer Wise.
In Europe, even up until World War II, if you see a picture of Leo Beck, talking to his synagogue
right
in Berlin.
Separate seating, yeah.
That was the average Reform, still separate.
Okay.
Well, now, sometimes churches also had separate seating.
Well, that's why the Reform synagogues maintained the way it did. They were imitating the church. Okay, so...
That was the second, right?
The second conference. Yeah, so let's discuss in the time we have left some of the other liturgical issues that were up for grabs. The Torah reading. What's problematic from the Reformer's point of view about the traditional Torah reading?
The length.
What else?
The language.
What else?
No women.
Yeah. Okay, what else?
The content, the belief.
The content, correct. All right. So all these are very serious problems. Let's address them one at a time. On the matter of length, well, one option is to return to a triennial cycle, which existed in Eretz Yisrael in classical times. You finish the Torah over a three-year period, not over a one-year period. So that is a very reasonable reform that has halachic sanction and would solve the problem of it taking too long. But it creates another interesting problem. How do you break up the reading? Do you do a true triennial cycle of following the Torah from Genesis 1:1 to Deuteronomy 34:12, week after week, continuing where you left off? Or do you do Parshas Lech Lecha a third this year, Parshas Lech Lecha a third next year, and Parshas Lech Lecha a third the year after, so that every week you have Parshas HaShavua, the same Parshas as everybody else? Now, the second one has merit in the sense that it preserves the commonality of Jewish experience. We all have the same Parshas HaShavua. The problem is it's very choppy, and it's inconsistent in your own congregation. Okay, the other question is, how often do you observe Simchas Torah? So they actually talk about this. And if you have the annual cycle, so you have Simchas Torah once a year. If you have a triennial, logic would dictate you could only have it once every 3 years, especially if you're not going to do the choppy way of a third this year, a third next year, a third the year after. If you're just going to get to Deuteronomy 34 only once every 36 months, so have Simchas Torah once every 3 years. So the argument in favor of keeping it was, well, people like Simchas Torah. The argument against it
that's a Frankel-style
argument. People like it, therefore keep it. Although he wasn't going triennial anyway, he was a Frumi who would want to keep the annual cycle. But the argument against it is, what is Simchas Torah? It's really just the second day of Shmini Atzeret that was invented 700 years ago in like the 13th century because the second day of Shmini Atzeret was becoming irrelevant in the Jewish public. Nobody likes the second day of Yom Tov, especially at the end of the whole Chagei Tishrei. So what do we do to boost the significance of the second day of Shmini Atzeret? We turn it into the annual celebration of the concluding of the Torah. So you make a siyum, yeah, with hakafas and dancing and the rikud. So because it's only 700 years old, it's not from time immemorial, it's not from Talmudic times. Therefore, it's only a minute. We can make it once every 3 years. We don't have to do it every year. Okay, that's the issue of length. What about the issue of language? So, reading the Torah in another language. Well, the scroll is in Hebrew. So what could you do? Well, you could have a translation like the Meturgaman of old. But the problem with that is, it takes a long time. I mean, have you ever been in a shul where they translate line after line? I've been in shuls where the rabbi gives a little bit of a drasha between each aliyah about what the next aliyah is going to contain. And it takes a long time. So how... You can't have a maturgaman in German. It's just not going to work. So they came to the conclusion, you could do it, but only on those Shabbatot, only on those weekends when the rabbi doesn't give a sermon. It's either a sermon or the Meturgaman, one or the other. You don't need both. It's a redundancy. On the assumption that the rabbi is going to speak about the weekly portion anyway. Okay. What was another concern? The aliyahs, calling people up for aliyah. The Committee on Liturgy wanted to abolish aliyot. You read the Torah, yes, but nobody is called up. No aufrufen, no calling people up. Because it gives the impression that the Torah is being read specifically for the person who is called up, and that everyone else is kind of irrelevant and can just talk among themselves about the stock market. So, by transforming the Torah reading from one in which there are seven official participants, there's an aliyah recipient, to just being the preacher or the precentor reading it out loud for the public, it transforms the flavor of the reading. Also, it means that everyone, not just the seven richest guys in the room, feel as though they're a part of the service. Also, it helps close the gender gap. Now, men aren't the only ones getting aliyahs, because nobody's getting an aliyah. So women don't get aliyahs, but men don't get them either. And the reformers of the 1840s were very aware of ill will towards tradition on the part of the women, because of the perceived bias in favor of men's dominance of the service. Now, did they really do anything about it? Not so much. One more thing they did on that front was to say that women can be counted in a minyan. This has been overlooked by the historians, but they did conclude that the rule, or rather the tradition, that only men can be counted for the quorum has no religious basis. No religious basis for the notion that only men count for a minyan. Okay. What about... Of course. It's all over the traditional sources. But when they say no religious basis, they don't mean it's not in the traditional sources. They mean religion, not in traditional Judaism, but their conception of religion. Not Yahadut of the Torah, but religion. It has no basis in religion. So... In Tanaitic times, it says in the Mishnah how many should be called up for on any given occasion, on Shabbos versus Yom Kippur versus Chagim. Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't all say abolish the distinction between Kohanim, Levim, and Israel.
That comes up in America in the 1880s. I believe it also comes up in 1869 at Augsburg, but it was not brought up in these rabbinical conferences. Yeah.
They all didn't say Aleph Brachot.
Right, so in the old days, the first person made the first bracha, the last person made the last bracha.
Some people called up, but they half a bracha at the beginning.
Half a bracha at the end, correct.
Between nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, that changed.
That changed because of Mishum HaNichnasim, Mishum HaYotzim, because people would come in late and walk out, and so the rabbis wanted to make sure people thought they were brachot. Yeah.
After these convocations, was there any implementation?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Oh, they did? There
plenty of synagogues changed the methods of the liturgy and the Torah service. Now, one other suggestion was, what about content, objectionable content? Mm-hmm. There are passages in the Torah that are not especially likable from the reformer's point of view.
Yehuda, Tamar.
So already the Talmud talks about how certain passages should not be translated, like the unseemly episodes in the book of Bereishis of Yehuda and Tamar, or Reuven and Bilhah. The Tannaitic literature has certain biblical sections that should not be translated. So the reformers took it one step further. Maybe we shouldn't read it at all. In other words, if it's a disgusting paragraph, let's not read it.
They do that today. I saw one of the ushers there that do something, and what they did was just basically...
So in certain Reform synagogues, they don't read Leviticus 20:13 because of LGBT considerations. In certain Reform synagogues, they will either not read it, or they'll read it without the trup. Without the trup. So...
Now, good old
Shalom. Okay. Another question. What about the messianic elements of prayer? Shall we be praying for the arrival of a personal Messiah, Mashiach, the man Mashiach? Here, you have a basic divide between the traditionalists and the radicals. The traditionalists say, well, let's keep the liturgy as is. We don't know how the redemption will manifest itself or what messianic times will look like. We'll leave it to God to figure that out, and we can keep Mevi Goel Livnei V'Nehem the way it is. However, the more radical types say, we're not anticipating a Davidic descendant becoming the king over the Jews. We're expecting a period of universal human brotherhood. So therefore, any declaration about messianic times that is particularistic about the people Israel and is about a Davidic descendant and about the restoration of the Jewish polity in the Holy Land, that's got to go. Instead, we'll speak of a glorious future for all of humanity. So, Mevi Geula, instead of Mevi Goel, which has become a popular replacement in many of the non-Orthodox synagogues to this day in America, Mevi Geula, instead of Mevi Goel. Well, from a Christian point of view, Mevi Geula is heresy, because the Christian point of view is there's a Goel. Now, their Goel came in the year 30 of the Common Era, but yeah, but there's a Goel.
Is there people that dropped out of the Reformed congregations because they went too far?
Yes, that does happen when a community is taken over by a heterodox rabbi and tries to turn the main communal synagogue into a new styled synagogue. So those who object to the reforms, or the improvements as they might call them, will establish for themselves a separatist Orthodox house of worship.
That explains Hirsch.
So that explains Hirsch, and many other similar situations where people paid for the privately funded a house of worship which was not supported by the general communal fund. And then the question is, well, at what point does the Orthodox separatist house of worship become an official communal institution?
Not necessarily because their people are Orthodox. As they say in Israel, the shul that I don't go to is an Orthodox shul.
Right, okay, yeah.
It just turns the
world. Okay, there were plenty of people among the laity who did not like radical reform, even if they themselves were not especially pious. But the question is, what do you do about it? If you care enough to establish an alternative house of worship, then you have to put your money where your mouth is and invest the resources. If you just don't like it, but want to just grumble and that's it, then you make a few nasty comments and that's it. I mean, it all depends upon the extent to which you're willing to fight the trend. All right.
But there is an irony in history to that, because today, if you take a look at the current Reformed prayer books, and even some of the conservative, but the Reformed primarily,
yeah,
you have Mechaye
Hakol.
Hakol. But you have Mechayim Mason back in
Mechayim,
there.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
but also Mevigal El is back in there.
And the reason for that is the same reason why the Reform prayer books brought back Kol Nidre after having been gone for 100 years. Because Reform Judaism is the Judaism for people who are moving away from rigorous observance, but who are coming from a point of reference of tradition. Reform Judaism is not the religion of the great-great-grandchildren of Reform Jews. Right. So therefore, a Reform Jew knows Mevi Goel. The Reform Jew knows Kol Nidre. Why? Because growing up in a different style synagogue, they had Mevi Goel and they had Kol Nidre. The fact that that synagogue or that style synagogue 100 years earlier didn't have it because they already abolished it is of no consequence. Only the historians know that, not the layman in the pew. He couldn't care less what happened 100 years ago. So it's all about the frame of reference. Yeah.
So many of these changes or not changes that we're talking about are not really deeply rooted in theology. It is more a question of either preserving synagogue attendance or doing a better job.
So that was the concern of the people who gathered, was to do a better job of maintaining the population within Judaism, within some kind of Judaism, within the pews. You know, what will work? However, others were real ideologues who felt that I don't care what works or what doesn't work. I don't believe in a messianic arrival. I don't believe in the getting gathering of the exiles. I don't believe in the restoration of a Jewish polity. Therefore, it's all got to go. So some people were real ideologues, but most were not. Most were concerned for the preservation of some form of Judaism that would be successful. Okay, what about Musaf? So you would think, if we're not praying for the restoration of the temple, then Musaf can be deleted completely. And yes, there were those who say Musaf's gone, no more Musaf. And I remember Rabbi Eugene Borowitz, the great Reform theologian, every Shabbos at the Great Neck Synagogue, sitting right in front of me and my father. And after the Haftorah, what did he do? He got up, he went to the coat room, got his coat, and he went home. Good Shabbos, and left. He had his own Kiddush at home, but there was no Musaf. So he davened in an Orthodox shul because he liked the Orthodox davening and he liked Chazen Shulman and he liked Rabbi Wolf, but he didn't daven Musaf. It wasn't for him. It wasn't his theology. But others said, no, we have to keep Musaf. Why? Because the structure of the Sabbath service, as is known to the people, fits a certain rhythm, a certain pattern that we're reluctant to give up on, and people will be upset if we give up on it. What's the pattern? The Shema and its blessings, the Shacharis, the Torah reading, the Haftorah, the Rabbi's sermon, the Musaf, and the Kiddush. So to take away a chunk of the Musaf is a pretty big block. And most people come late to shul, so what are they there for? They're there for the Musaf. So to say it's gone is really changing things. So although ideologically there may have been good reason to get rid of it, practically there isn't such good reason to get rid of it. Unless you absolutely insist that we have to shorten the service. Okay, so...
Why they never even considered going on to a solar calendar?
No.
That's a surprise.
No, absolutely not. And why not? Maybe because that was too far, a step too far. Okay, what about the repetition of the Shmona Esrei? So what is the reason for the repetition of the Shmona Esrei? Traditionally.
Didn't know how to read.
So people didn't know how to pray. Therefore, the precentor, the chazan, the shliach tzibur, says it out loud on their behalf. They respond amen, and they fulfill their obligation. But if that's the case, why do I need a silent Shmona Esrei? Why don't I just have the out loud one? Because why have it twice? So there are people who do know how to pray, and it's better for them to do it themselves than to listen to somebody else. Alternatively, to allow the chazan an opportunity to prepare the davening in his mind as he says it quietly before he says it aloud. In the era before Sidurim, the Gemara says this, lehasdir tfilato, that he should order the prayers in his own mind before he says them aloud.
Isn't the Sephardic from Musaf,
yeah,
where they started off like a hecha Musaf?
Some places do that, yes.
So I
remember in Sharitzion of Great Neck they used to do that. Some places do, like a Hecha Kedusha of Musaf. It saves time. It saves time. So,
and cuts down on talking.
You would hope it cuts down on talking. On the assumption that people are actually praying, it definitely cuts down on talking. The problem is, if the people's liturgical ability is so limited that when there's any quiet time, they're going to speak. It doesn't actually serve that purpose. That's what I've found over the years. Yeah. Your question? Okay. So, what about the organ? So the organ was a very simple open and shut case. Ein shvut b'mikdash. There are no rabbinic decrees in the temple. Meaning, Shabbat is Shabbat, but Shabbat has rabbinic laws. Gedarim, a fence around the Torah. So there are certain things we don't do by rabbinic rule, lest we come to transgress the biblical Sabbath law. In the Beit HaMikdash, none of those rules hold true. Only the biblical law holds true. So, the synagogue is the Beit HaMikdash. Now, is the synagogue really the Beit HaMikdash? In their mind, it is. Because the Mikdash Ma'at has now replaced the Beit HaMikdash HaGadol, the big one, because it isn't coming back in their view. So, Ein Shvut Mikdash, you're not allowed to play music on the Sabbath by rabbinic rule. So, in the temple, in the holy temple, you can play the organ. That's their ruling. What about by a Jew on Shabbos, not by a Gentile? So in 1819, in the Hamburg controversy, one of the ways for the non-traditionalists to escape the criticism of the Talmudists was to say, well, Amira Lenachri, we're going to tell a Gentile to do it. By the 1840s, Amira Lenachri's out the window. A Jew is going to do it. A Jew is going to do it. So the passage of time allows for a greater freedom of movement in departures from the traditional halakha.
So it's getting used to one thing, and once you get
used to it, you do one even more. You do even more. Okay, so we'll stop here. Next week, we'll discuss the third conference at Breslau, where the Shabbos issue comes up. And infamously, the suggestion that Shabbos should be observed on Sunday.